Support for this program comes from Jazz on the Tube, the Internet's largest collection of free streamable classic jazz videos. From Miles Davis to Louis Armstrong, from Thelonious Monk to Duke Ellington, you'll find it all on jazzonthetube.com. Start your free subscription today.
Hi, this is Ken McCarthy of Jazz on the Tube, and today we're going to talk about a topic that I've had on my agenda for quite a while, but it's become more acute and more important these days, and you'll see why in a second. We have done a lot of programming on Latin jazz in the last 2 years with a focus on Cuba. We wanted to support people who were interested in going to Cuba so that when they went to Cuba, they'd be informed. Well, as we all know, there was a terrible series of hurricanes in Puerto Rico. And I think everybody that's aware of the news knows that the people of Puerto Rico have not been given the aid that they need and deserve as American citizens. And so to raise awareness about Puerto Rico, we've been doing a lot of programming specifically on Puerto Rican contributions to jazz. And they are many and they are significant. And today we have a guest who's going to help us understand them a little better. Now, this is a deep subject, and really, there's a lot to it, so we're not going to be able to cover it all in an hour. The goal, though, is to give you the ABCs. So, everybody, I'm very happy today welcoming Tomas Pena. Welcome, Tomas.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And Tomas is one of the central journalists in the Latin jazz scene. You can see his work in Hot House magazine if you're a New Yorker. That's a great magazine that's given out every month for jazz fans. And he handles the Latin side of Hot House. He's also the editor-in-chief of jazzdelapena.com. Just go there. If you want to understand this field, that's one of the first stops to make. He's also been the co-editor and a contributing writer to the Latin Jazz Network since 2000. And there's a whole lot of other things he's done, too. But just so you know, he's an important source if you want to understand the Latin jazz scene. And by the way, I just want to say this. The Latin jazz scene is a lot of fun, and the music is consistently amazing. So don't think of it as some kind of a sideline or something off, you know, exotic. It is right in the center of our music. And I'll say it, I think it's some of the best music that's being produced in the jazz world today. And believe me, the more you get into it, the richer you're going to feel musically. So, Tomas, we had a chance to talk earlier, and you told a fascinating story about how you discovered Latin jazz. Now, you're a Latin guy, Tomas Pena, but right. But you had to discover Latin jazz. So
yeah.
tell us the story how that happened.
Well, so I grew up, you know, surrounded by typical Puerto Rican music, and you know, basically during my time as a child, radio was big, and so I grew up raised by my grandmother who came to this country, never spoke English, and she sort of represented the Puerto Rican side of my culture, and my mother, who came to the United States when she was two, and she was very Americanized. So we listened to, you know, the typical folkloric and romantic tunes of Puerto Rico on the radio, and then my mother would listen to Frank Sinatra, you know. So it was a real mix of stuff that I heard, but in terms of Latin jazz, that wasn't really on the plate yet. You know, it was coming, you know. So, and also my father was a musician, a guitarist who played in trios. And these were trios that sang kind of romantic or nostalgic tunes, usually like three people. And for a time, it was a very popular genre. I would offer up as an example, Trio Los Panchos, which was that kind of music. So in any case, I joined the military in 1965 and U.S. Navy. And I was stationed out of Long Beach, California. And when we weren't overseas, which was most of the time, my shipmates and I, mostly African-Americans, because there was a lot of self-segregation going on these ships at the time, listened to West Coast radio. And during one of those listening sessions, I was struck by guitarist Wes Montgomery's Bumpin' on Sunset, and that's a jazzy tune with Latin elements. And it was something that I had never really either heard before or had not paid attention to before. But later on, I found out that the Latin side of that tune was actually Ray Barreto, who was a sideman for many of these jazz recordings, you know, that, and people, a lot of people don't know it, but he was jazz artist before he was popular in the salsa vein. So in any case, the tune sparked my interest in jazz and Latin music, and it prompted me to frequent clubs in Los Angeles and Hollywood. And at that particular time, Mongo Santa Maria was on the West Coast, Cal Jader, Willie Bobo, many of these groups that were forerunners, and they were in their prime, and I was there and I saw it all. And so when I was released from the military in 1968 and I returned to New York, I became a frequenter of the Village Gate, the Salsa Meets Jazz series, the Blue Note, the Village Vanguard, and countless other venues that no longer exist. And as I got deeper and deeper into it, you know, I became addicted to not just Latin jazz, but also, you know, there's a lot of colors there in terms of, you know, different combinations that you saw. But, or as Ray Barreto used to say, Latin and jazz, Latin jazz is really sort of, I kind of compare it to the umbrella term salsa. You know, it covers a lot of ground, but it doesn't really, to the average listener, you wouldn't get the specifics of what you need, what's really being played. But Latin jazz is what stuck, and so that's how I got into it, and the rest is history. I mean, I just became addicted to it, started collecting, and then eventually wanting to write about what I saw, and it snowballed from there into getting involved with Latin Jazz Network, originally as a contributing writer, and then later as a co-editor, and then out of that, the Jazz de la Peña site was a spinoff and affiliated with Latin Jazz Network. We still work together, and then more recently, I was approached by Hot House Magazine and asked if I wanted to write the feature column, the Latin side of Hot House, and of course I jumped on that chance because that magazine is 82 years old, and for many years there was nothing that really was specific about, you know, what was going on the Latin side of things. So I'm very proud to be able to write that piece, and it's been great because I've been able to feature artists that normally would not have been in that magazine or would have been a footnote. So that's a brief, you know, recap of that. You know, my career, I just covered 16 years there, so that's a, you know,
yeah.
It's a lot of, well,
The interaction between jazz and Latin music has been going on for a long, long time. I've done some reading about even New Orleans. Quite a few of Cuban and Puerto Rican and Mexican musicians, influenced by Cuba. And this is a small point, but it's probably worth mentioning. There's really two streams of Hispanic or Latino culture. One is Caribbean-based, and the other, we'll say, is mainland-based, for lack of a better word. And so the mainland-based would be influenced by the Aztec civilization and the Mayan civilization and all the many, many different nations that are in Mexico and throughout South America. But in the Caribbean, it's African-influenced.
Absolutely.
And there's been a camaraderie between African Americans in the United States and Latin Caribbean people too, because they share a root culture.
Absolutely, absolutely. I'm going to read you a quote from which actually sort of encapsulates that, and that's actually from the book "Cuba and Its Music" by Ned Sublett.
Oh yeah.
And he has a paragraph in there that says, and I quote: "As soon as Puerto Ricans were Americans, they were helping transform its music. From 1917 on, there is no African-American music in New York in which Puerto Ricans don't figure. They have been a natural part of the jazz in New York before cats were taking improvised solos, and as the Latin jazz hybrid developed, they provided critical links between the African-American and Cuban styles because they were the ones who understood them both and made them their own in their own way. The unique bicultural sophistication of the Puerto Rican is a deep topic for another book, but it can't be left unmentioned in talking about the development of the music in New York." That's the end of the quote. What I would add to that is that what you just said about how, even before that, if you read, for example, Louis Armstrong's biography, he mentions a number of Puerto Rican musicians who were in New Orleans that influenced him. Mm. You know, so it goes way back. I mean, so that stuff that here is touching on, he's touching on New York, but actually it's much deeper than that. It's a very deep topic. Another person that spoke about that very eloquently is the late Juan Flores, who was a historian and scholar, and he wrote many books on the music. And he said, I've always felt that the Puerto Ricans and jazz is like a secret society. You know, he says, you know, Puerto Ricans have evolved a way of playing jazz, which is not what the Cubans do. You know, it's not just Latin jazz necessarily, although Latin jazz, which I feel like rides in the back of the jazz bus, is very much a pan-Latin kind of language in which anybody can play. But he states, you know, for example, and we talked about this in our last conversation, he talks about Papo Vasquez in particular, because Papo Vasquez has a way of playing jazz that is very Puerto Rican, you know. And he's one of the fathers of what they call bomba jazz, plena jazz, meaning that he takes Puerto Rican folkloric rhythms and he incorporates them into a jazz format in a way that nobody else does, you know. So there's an approach that, you know, that Puerto Ricans have when they play jazz that's very different from the way anybody else would approach jazz, you know.
You know, it's very interesting that you mentioned the Cuban connection too, because numerically, pretty much there have always been more Puerto Ricans in New York City than Cubans, and especially after the you know, 61. So in terms of helping transmit all that great culture, musical culture from Cuba to the United States, that was largely done by Puerto Ricans. They're the ones that carried the tradition and integrated it with the rest of America's music. So, yeah, they it's interesting. Yeah, I hadn't really thought of that, but they're sort of the central pivot between Western, we'll call it Western jazz or Northern jazz, and Cuban music.
Yeah.
In fact, let's get into some of the history, and we're going to get into the like I said, just the ABCs here, because this is a deep subject, but there's a couple of fundamental stories that every jazz fan really needs to know, and it's going to enrich your appreciation of the music greatly. Let's talk about James Europe Reese.
Okay. Yeah. So, you know, Europe traveled to Puerto Rico in May of 1917 to recruit soldiers for his military band. And the big question has always been, you know, why did Europe go to Puerto Rico? Why didn't he go to Europe? He went to recruit reed players. To be more specific, he went to recruit 8 clarinets, 2 flutes, 4 horns, 1 bassoon, 2 oboes, 2 baritones, 2 tubas, 2 saxophones, and sight readers. And the key word there is sight readers, because at that particular time, James Buse Europe had some killer musicians in his bands, but they couldn't read music because of the racism in the United States. Many of them learned music outside of the formal training. So he was putting together this military band, which he wanted to be the best band possible, and he chose Puerto Rico. There are many theories surrounding who the connection was between Europe and Puerto Rico and all that, but that's another story for another day. Basically, he went there and recruited 18 Afro-Puerto Ricans and came back to the United States with them, made them part of the band. And that band, unbeknownst to many people, was the band that introduced, I'm not going to say jazz because it wasn't really the jazz as we know it today. Some people call it proto-jazz, but introduced a form of jazz to France that had never been heard before. And it was a seminal moment when highly skilled Latin Puerto Rican musicians came into contact with black American music and learned to play jazz over the course of the war. So, you know, it was significant. And when you look at the pictures of the band, you see, you would think that it's all African Americans. And much of the story has been told from that perspective, with the exception of a few books and one which I'm going to recommend. But basically, the 18 Puerto Ricans who came to the United States, you know, recruits, and they were a significant part of that band because they were able to read music. And the way Europe would position them was he would put the people that could read music. He would station the African American musicians who couldn't read music around the people who could read music so they could follow what they were doing. So, you know, with the passage of time, the story has been put on the back burner. It's a deep topic. It has been explored somewhat, but mainly told from the African-American perspective. And I would say that the most famous of the 18 musicians that came over was Rafael Hernandez, who everybody knows for the many hits that he had, and also for he wrote the unofficial Puerto Rican anthem. So it's a deep topic, you know, and I would say that the best book on that I haven't been able to find anything that exceeds what Ruth Glasser did in the book, My Music is My Flag, Puerto Rican Musicians and Their New York Communities, 1917 to 1940. And she talks about that extensively and gets into it a lot deeper than I can and a lot more eloquently than I could. But there are articles that have been written about it also, but no significant book that actually tells the story of the Puerto Ricans from beginning to end. First of all, because it was 100 years ago and many of the people, the principals, are no longer around, there's not a lot of material from that aspect. And, you know, over time, stories become diluted, people forget, but it's a very significant topic, and Puerto Ricans were there from the beginning.
I'd like to point out a few things, too, about the story. And I, by the way, I misspoke. It's James Reese Europe. James Reese
Europe. Yeah, James Reese Europe.
Reese.
Right, right.
But everyone, try to imagine. Well, first of all, let's acknowledge that Puerto Ricans became citizens in 1917. People don't know that, but let's make sure at least us jazz fans know that. So it's 100 years of citizenship. And I believe they were made citizens in time so that they could become soldiers in World War I, which they did do. And they served admirably. And by the way, they've served admirably in all wars.
Absolutely.
Everywhere you can think of. So that's an important point. But the other thing we have to remember, 1917, no airplanes. Mm-hmm. I venture to say you couldn't make a phone call to Puerto Rico in 1917 from the U.S. So the fact that Europe went all the way down to Puerto Rico to recruit these 18 musicians, I mean, somewhere along the line, a very powerful impression was made on him that if you wanted a musical treasure,
that's right,
Puerto Rico was where you were going to find it. And think about it, 18 musicians, that is like the core of a band. And then the other thing that's, I think, important is Europe was very conscious about the fact that he was bringing Afro-American, and by that I mean in the biggest sense, not Afro-United Statesian, but Afro-American Americas, that he was bringing an Afro-American aesthetic in music to Europe. He was very conscious of that, and I think it's really significant that his engine was made up of 18 sight-reading, Top Gun Puerto Rican musicians. I think it's a really important part of American music history, and I'm now you know it. Now all our listeners know this. His name is James Reese Europe, and he's a great, great pioneer of American music. In a broad strokes thing that we're doing on this call, because as Tomas has pointed out, there's a lot of deep scholarship in this subject that you can dive into. So we're just doing broad strokes. The next big story that I believe every jazz fan should be aware of is Juan Tizol. Now, everybody kind of knows that he was around. He wrote Caravan. But the story is a lot more important than that. So, Tomas, could you tell us a little bit about Juan Tizol?
Yeah, sure. One of the crazy things about Juan Tizol is that he came to New York to the States as a stowaway. But that's a whole nother. Yeah, he stowed away. And actually, the theory is that he paid the crew to let him hang out on the ship. And that's how he came to the United States. But anyway, so he's best known as a member of the Duke Ellington Orchestra, but what is not really known as much is that he was a consummate musician, a composer, arranger, sight reader, transcriber, and the first significant player to use the valve trombone in a jazz setting. Now, you don't see the valve trombone anymore because it's an outdated instrument, but It sounded like a cross between a trumpet and a trombone. And up to that point, it had only been used in military bands, and he took it into a big band setting. You know, so he revolutionized the instrument. You know, but also I should give credit to Basilio Serrano, who wrote the book, Juan Tizol, is Caravan Through American Life and Culture. And everything that you want to know about Juan Tizol is in that book because it's really well-researched. And also he lays out a very interesting theory. And that theory is that Tizol is one of the unsung founders of Latin jazz. And why is that? And that's because Latin jazz, technically, the story about Latin jazz and where it, you know, where its origin was, technically, if you ask people, they will say Mario Balsa, 1947, New York City. So Serrano was saying, well, hey, what about Juan Tizol, who was experimenting with Latin rhythms and jazz in Duke Ellington's orchestra as far back as 1935? You know, so that's something to consider. And also, the other thing to consider is that Tizol was a racial trailblazer because he was one of the few white people in Ellington's band, and he suffered a lot of reverse discrimination, and even to the point where there were two movies made, which I don't have the names of in front of me, where they actually blackened his face for the films to make him fit in with the rest of the band.
Mm.
Yeah. So very interesting guy. You know, the story is a lot deeper than what most people would think. I mean, like, you know, when you mention Tizol, the word that generally comes up is, oh yeah, he's the composer of Caravan. But he did a lot more than that. I mean, he's just a really deep cat who did very, very well for himself in terms of his career. Came here, didn't speak English, stowed away, made his way to Washington, played at, you know, that's where he met, at the Howard Theater was where he met Ellington. And that relationship, you know, just went practically into, you know, into his older years. And then he played with many other great band leaders and composed and transcribed and did incredible work right up until his death.
Now, was he the musical director of the Ellington Orchestra for a while?
He was the musical director when Ellington was away.
Okay.
And so he would break in the new musicians, teach them the repertoire, rehearse them and all that, yeah.
So that's pretty significant when Duke Ellington puts you in charge when he's away. We got to know that Duke Ellington's musical standards were sky high, and it's just very significant that Juan Tizol is the man that he went with.
Yeah, I mean, he's, you know, if you read Ellington's biography, he speaks very highly of Tizol in the highest possible terms. You know, he was musician's musician, and you know, there's that famous story of, I think I mentioned it to you last time we spoke, about he was rehearsing with Charles Mingus. Ellington was away. He was rehearsing Charles Mingus for a particular piece, and Mingus couldn't get the piece down, and he was known to be somewhat volatile. He attacked Tizol, and there's a whole, you know, mystique around that story. But basically what happened was is that he, you know, when Ellington came back, he told Mingus that he couldn't be in the band. But, yeah, it's there's a lot of stuff, man. There's just a lot of history there that, you know, you have to read the book, Juan Tizol, His Caravan Through Life in American Culture, and you'll get a really good picture of who Juan Tizol was.
And so in addition to playing the valve trombone and writing two classics, really, Caravan and Perdido with Ellington, he also did just a lot of the background work that you know, that's part of a big band. For instance, he would copy parts, you know, and he was apparently known as the best or one of the best sight readers.
Absolutely, in the
band.
Yeah,
and it's also interesting if sometimes you see film of him, and he is sometimes the sole trombone in a reed section in a saxophone section.
Exactly,
which is really tricky. You really got to have a good ear and really be able to blend well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, normally the brass and the reeds are segregated, so to combine a trombone in with the reeds is another significant thing.
Well, it was a valve trombone, and so the valve trombone has this sound that's sort of in between the reeds and the brass, and that's mm-hmm. why he was able to do it, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah.
So everybody, I think every jazz fan knows that Duke Ellington and that orchestra was absolutely one of the cores of our music. It was a pivot point. It elevated the music to a very high level. It's amazing how many avant-garde musicians, like for instance Cecil Taylor, I remember hearing him talk about the impression, the impact that seeing Ellington's band had on his psyche. You know, it just completely transformed him as a person. So we know that about Ellington, and it's so interesting to know that in that mix was this Puerto Rican musician that brought tremendous skills, you know, in the mechanics of music, in the profession of music. This is a theory I'm going to throw out. We haven't talked about this, but it's known that, Puerto Rican musicians were very, very well trained in reading and in the mechanics of music.
Yeah.
And also in New Orleans, there's two traditions in New Orleans. There's Creole musicians who were also very well trained in the fundamentals of music, sight reading, sight singing. In fact, I was talking with a guy, he was in excess of 100 years old, and he was not even allowed to touch an instrument until he mastered sight singing. That was the part of his training as a kid.
As well in Puerto Rico.
It's the same thing. It's the same thing. And I'm wondering, and this is real speculation, and we're kind of going far afield, but it's kind of interesting. As a lot of our listeners know, the island of Haiti, for a time, was an extremely rich place materially. In fact, it produced one-third of all the foreign revenue for France from the sugar plantations. And it had a tremendous musical culture. It had opera houses. It had music conservatories. There's even a man who was part of that cultural milieu, a black man, who literally funded some of Mozart's compositions. So we're talking about a very, very high musical culture. When Haiti, you know, basically burned to the ground during its revolution, it wasn't just a revolution. It was a literal scorched earth. I mean, the whole place was just burned to the ground, basically. A lot of people left. Some of them went to Puerto Rico.
Yes.
Some of them went to New Orleans. And I have a feeling that that tradition of thorough, serious music practice emanated from Haiti. This is just a speculation on my part. Yeah.
I would argue that you know, Spain played a big role in that, because in Puerto Rico in particular, and that's because they started the municipal band tradition, which was a tradition where, first of all, music was incorporated into the education system in Puerto Rico. It was part of everyday life. And second of all, whether you were rich or poor, the municipal bands turned out highly trained musicians. And like the musicians in Haiti, they were not allowed to touch an instrument for approximately 2 years until they learned solfeo. And that's where all the recruits came from, out of the municipal bands, you know.
What is solfeo?
Solfeo is you have to learn how to sing the music, every note, before you can pick up an instrument.
Gotcha.
And
so
it's a 2 year, it's almost like a, you know, depending on, of course, you know, some people adapt to the system quicker than others, but basically what I read was that, you know, it would be 2 years before you'd even lay hands on an instrument. So many of these, you know, the people that ran these municipal bands initially, many of them were from Spain. They intermarried in Puerto Rico, decided to stay, and many of them were highly trained musicians. And later on, you have these families that were, you know, I can't think of the word right now, but dynasties, you know, and that's where, you know, that's where Tizol came out of. Tizol came out of a dynasty family. You know, Manuel Tizol, his uncle, had played in the symphony orchestra. He had a municipal band where all the musicians practically came out of these bands, and they were highly trained sight readers. They could play multiple instruments. They could play in any context, and you could see that when they came to New York, and all of a sudden they're faced with having to play African-American jazz, and they adapt. Not only do they adapt, but they excel.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that shows you the degree of the pedigree that they had, you know?
You know, it's interesting, if anybody gets a chance to go to Cuba and to Havana in particular, down in the Plaza de Armas, I forget what day it is, but they still have a municipal band in Havana, and they play for the public once a week. And these guys are world class.
Absolutely.
They had a clarinet player that, I mean, he could be a superstar anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And about dynasties, you know, Cachao, the great Cuban bass player, I think I read somewhere like he has like 28, he had 28 relatives who played the bass. Like it literally was a dynasty of, of musicians.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. Wow. The municipal band, the story of the municipal band is the subject of another book. I mean, that mm-hmm. because really, if you trace that whole, the history of the municipal bands, which, by the way, there are still many municipal bands in Puerto Rico, one of the biggest being the Firemen's Municipal Band in Ponce.
Oh.
That story is incredible because that's where all these guys came out of, and many of them wind up in the United States, you know, after the war, they come back, Europe dies suddenly, and now they disperse and start playing with, you know, in some cases, some of them returned to Puerto Rico, and others played in various jazz bands. Some of them changed their names. Some of them you wouldn't recognize because in the photos, again, it looks like it's a group of African Americans, but they just blended right in. And like, for example, in Rafael Hernandez's case, he played with a musician named Lucky. I can't remember the guy's last name. Lucky, can't remember. But anyway, these guys adapted. By that time, they were fluent in jazz, and they were able, because of that, they were able to now migrate into African American jazz bands and just blend right in.
Amazing.
So,
you know, so when we look at jazz in America, we must always keep in mind and remember the Puerto Rican contribution to the music. It's there at every stage. It was there in New Orleans. It was there in the Ellington Orchestra. It was there in the proto jazz band of James Reese Europe. It was there in the Ellington Orchestra, and it's always been there. You made reference to the really rich cultural explosion that happened in the 60s out in the West Coast.
Yeah,
and then there was something comparable, obviously, in New York City. So then you mentioned Salsa Meets Jazz, mm-hmm. I think that's the name of it, at the Village Gate. And that might be a way for us to start talking about the quote, modern era. For people that missed it, because it's long gone, but tell people about what Salsa Meets Jazz was like, what it was all about.
So on Monday nights, every Monday, they would have a salsa band and they would have a jazz musician sit in. And I remember seeing, for example, John Faddis sitting in with a salsa band and duking it out with Luis Perico Ortiz. And in fact, I just spoke to Luis Perico Ortiz a couple of days ago, and I mentioned that particular duel between him and John, and he remembered it. And this is way back. I mean, and he said the reason that I came to New York was because of jazz. He said I wanted to learn, you know, get involved with meet the cats, jam with them, and learn more about jazz. And of course, today he is an educator in Puerto Rico, and he has a jazz big band, and he also has a small jazz group of his own. Even though he's known mainly for his work in the salsa field, he's a jazz fanatic, you know. Mm. So anyway, the Salsa Meets Jazz was basically a salsa band and a prominent jazz musician sitting in with them, and there was all this interaction, and you never knew how it was going to go. But I mean, I never went there on any night and walked away disappointed for two reasons. One, it was interesting to see that combination, and second of all, you would see a lot of these Puerto Rican musicians who you knew them in a salsa context, and all of a sudden they would jump out and start improvising, and you were totally surprised because you had never seen them, you know, you had never seen their range up until that point, you know. And so a lot of these Puerto Rican musicians were steeped in jazz. It's just that they were making a living playing in a salsa band, but if you put them up against a jazz artist, many times they just, you know, they were right there with them. And,
right, and it's like for everyone else, there's practical considerations, and if 95.999% of your gigs are salsa gigs, well, you're going to go where the gigs are, but you might be able to, right? And we, by the way, we're talking about a club that is physically still there, but under a different name. But the name of that club was the Village Gate,
right?
And this I think this is one of the great unheralded, you know, people talk about Birdland, and as they should, and all those clubs, but people really should talk about Sosomys Jazz at the Village Gate. I believe it was started by Sonny Fortune.
No, it was somebody else that started it, but I can't remember the name right now, but it may have, but well, actually the person that introduced the concept was Symphony Sid, and he was a famous disc jockey. And who had a very famous, popular radio show. And there's a tune actually that's dedicated to him called "Jumpin' with Symphony Sid." You've probably heard it. He was the one that came up with the concept, as far as I know. And he was very locked into the Latin scene. And he was the one that came up with the concept. And then it went from there. After many years, the Village Gate closed down. It became a pharmacy. And then these young guys came in, wanted to bring back not exactly what it was, but sort of a new, more modern version of what the old Village Gate was. And they opened up La Poison Rouge, is what it's called now.
Yeah. And very nice place.
Yeah. So if you walk in if you are old enough to remember the old Village Gate and you walk into the room, a lot of it has not really changed. You know, it's been cleaned up and all that, but the basic structure of the place remains the same. So it's very nostalgic for people that, you know, that are old enough to have remembered the you know, what happened back then. Physically, I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And, you know, many attempts have been made to bring that concept back, and nobody has ever really succeeded in making it the way it was.
Well, we'll keep trying. Maybe we'll get it right one of these days, because it will be amazing. When it gets reignited, and I think maybe the time is right to take another whack at it.
Yeah, just to say one thing, the education system has changed so much that now you have like young guys coming out of music school playing, you know, John Coltrane's licks, you know, by rote. You know, back then it was a whole different story. I mean, you know, you just didn't expect these guys to be able to, because you didn't know them in that context. You didn't expect to see them play against the jazz. But today, these students are coming out so enriched, you know, with education that, you know, it's a whole different scene now. It can never be the same, you know. But, yeah, you know what I mean? The level of the education has brought the music up to an entirely new place.
Which is an encouraging thing. You mentioned Symphony Sid, and I think a lot of jazz fans are aware that Symphony Sid was a spokesman for bebop.
Yes.
But they're not as aware that he was equally passionate for Latin music. And this is something we haven't prepared to talk about, but I'd just be interested in your impressions. A lot of people don't know that Birdland and the old Palladium, the Palladium Ballroom, were just a block apart. I mean, they were
– Exactly.
So people could in the 40s and the 50s, and they could just go from Birdland, you know, and hear some bebop, and then stroll up the street and hear Tito Puente. So anything to contribute on that subject of the Palladium? That might be news to a lot of people that there was once a huge Latin jazz, Latin orchestra scene in New York City. In fact, pre-rock and roll, it was the scene.
Yes, absolutely. There are a lot of stories about Tito Puente between sets running over to hear, you know, a jazz musician is playing across the street and vice versa. There was a lot of interaction. And, for example, probably, you know, one of the interactions that you can listen to would be, you know, Charlie Parker playing with the Machito Orchestra. Okay, so you had all that interaction between running back and forth, listening to each other, you know, being inspired by each other. There was this close proximity, you know, and it was, you know, I mean, I would have loved to have been there to see that and witness that, because that was such an incredible time for that interaction between the jazz musicians and the Latin musicians. And a lot of it, you know, like I say, as time passes, people don't talk about it as much. But that interaction is what brought us to where we are today, you know, in terms of, you know, it's just so that influence.
And then commercially, Dizzy Gillespie got together with Chano Pozzo and recorded Manteca.
Right.
And my understanding, I could be wrong, but that recording was his greatest hit ever. And if it wasn't his greatest hit ever, it definitely was one of his most successful commercial ventures. And that really woke anybody that wasn't awake to Latin music and the potential of it for working together with jazz music, that really woke a lot of people up. And there was sort of a flood of Latin-oriented jazz albums by everybody. You mentioned Wes Montgomery.
Yes.
But everybody got into the mix at that time because it had commercial potential as well as artistic potential.
Right. Well, one of the people that it woke up was Ray Barreto. He was in the military at the time, and who was stationed overseas, and he used to listen to the radio like many, you know, people in the military do. And he heard Chano Pozo, Dizzy Gillespie, and that was a defining moment in his life where he said, "I know what I want to do now," you know.
Mm.
Ray Barreto is an NEA jazz master, okay, which is the highest, you know, the highest award our nation gives to jazz musicians, you know. So he was inspired by that. He again, like many musicians, was known for his work in the salsa field. But what a lot of people don't know about Ray Barreto is that before he became Manos Duras, so, you know, Hard Hands, what they called him, was his nickname, he was a sideman for the Prestige, Blue Note, Riverside, and Columbia labels. And he recorded with Red Garland, Gene Ammons, Eddie Lockjaw Davis, Oliver Knudsen, Kenny Burrell, Lou Donaldson, Art Former, Yosef Lateef, Herbie Mann, Wes Montgomery, and Dizzy Gillespie, among others. And he spent the last 10 years of his life leading the jazz group New World Spirit. And shortly before his death, he received, you know, he was crowned an NEA Jazz Master by the National Endowment of the Arts. And I'm very fortunate to say that I was there and I saw that speech. It was interesting because after the ceremony, we went to another club, which doesn't exist now, and Ray Barreto was sitting at the bar with his wife. And I went over to him and I said, you know, Ray, I just want you to know that in my view, you know, this is a long time in coming. I mean, I've always seen you as a jazz master, even before this. And he was very humble. And Bobby Sinatra was playing with an orchestra at the time, and he invited Ray Barreto to jam with him. And Ray Barreto took a timbales solo, which I had never seen. And then that was his last performance. He died he was admitted into the hospital a couple of days later, and then like 2 weeks later, he died. So his career came full circle. He started out as a jazz musician, went into salsa, left salsa when the salsa romantica phase came in, you know, where salsa was sort of diluted and it became more about the singer than the musicians. And he went back to jazz, spent the last 10 years of his life leading a jazz band, and he died an NEA Jazz Master, you know. So he's a shining example of a musician who had an amazing career in the salsa world and an equally amazing career in the jazz world. And he straddled both of those worlds, you know, incredibly. A musician's musician. You mention his name and everybody just, you know, says, you know, he was the man, you know. So,
You know, this I'm realizing this could easily be a multi-hour, if not multi-day, call. But yeah. let's talk about something in our last minutes together, which is the jazz scene in Puerto Rico pre-hurricanes, because some people may not be aware that there is a thriving jazz scene in Puerto Rico. I'm thinking in terms of, for example, the great work that the Heineken Jazz Festival does down there.
Yes,
but there's a lot more. So let's talk a little bit, if you would, about the scene down there, and then let's end up by talking about the need today, what we as jazz fans need to do. And I say we as jazz fans because, look, the rest of the country, I'm very sorry and sad to say, has already moved on and is not paying attention. And if jazz fans who understand the roots of this music. I mean, look, let's face it. I was there. It was jazz musicians and jazz fans that got New Orleans back on its feet. It was the music. The musicians were the first people back. They were the first activities going on. No, with no electricity, bands were playing, boosted people's spirits. It started to attract tourists to come back. And by the way, it took – now New Orleans is booming now. But I can tell you it was not booming from 05 to about 11. So that was about 6 long years that it was really the music and the musicians and the musical culture that kept New Orleans on its feet. And so tell us a little about the scene in Puerto Rico.
In my view, the jazz scene in Puerto Rico was it was a small scene. It has grown over the years. It has grown somewhat, but I don't think that jazz in Puerto Rico has ever really gotten its due. What changed things was when Berklee came to Puerto Rico. And now you had Puerto Rican musicians who were now educating the youth, and out of that comes people like Miguel Zenon, David Sanchez. They come out of that Berklee scene, and they go on to become incredible musicians in their own right. But when I was in Puerto Rico, and I don't go there that often. I mean, I would go there maybe like once every 5 or 6 years at a time. And when I went, there was a couple of jazz clubs, but mainly the scene that I saw was mainly popular music, rock, and a lot of Dominican music, you know? Mm. And now it's a little different because of Berklee. Berklee has changed a lot of that. So you have, for example, on Monday nights, you have Humberto Ramirez, a trumpet player in Puerto Rico, and his big band play every Monday at a particular club. You have Charlie Sepulveda, who's a master trumpeter, and his group, who's very popular, and he just was up for a Grammy for an album that he did called Mr. EP, because dedicated to Eddie Palmieri, who's actually his cousin. And you have Luis Perico Ortiz, who's teaching at the conservatory in Puerto Rico and has a jazz big band and small group. And so there's a lot of these Puerto Rican musicians who now have the opportunity to teach through Berklee are churning out some really incredible musicians. But prior to Berklee, I think it was a mixed bag.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. So now what's happening is, and also it depends on who you speak to, but, you know, many of the venues were destroyed and or closed because they couldn't sustain themselves, you know, while all this was going on. And, you know, depending on who you speak to. So, for example, I've spoken to trombonist, composer, arranger, educator William Cepeda, and who comes from a dynasty family of people who have maintained, Puerto Rico's folkloric traditions. He's a little more progressive than his parents because he's more into the jazz scene, like sort of world music and jazz. But he... In his case, he is moving to Orlando, Florida. He's been displaced, and he's going to, you know, kind of keep an eye on what's going on in Puerto Rico and return to the island when things stabilize. And that's what a lot of musicians are having to do to support their families. So in the case of trumpeter, composer, arranger, band leader, producer, educator, Luis Perico Ortiz, who I just spoke to, and who's going to be celebrating 55 years of his career at Lehman Center for the Performing Arts on January 20th, he has more work than he can handle, you know? And he attributes that to the fact that he has always believed in that you should not do one thing. You should be diversified. So he does jingles. He does production company where he does stuff for Disney. He works with Quincy Jones. He teaches, and he's very diversified, you know, as a businessman. Now, when I spoke to him, he was online trying to get his internet service back, which he had not had internet service in his office for 80 days.
Mm.
But he said, you know, I have more work than I can handle, and I don't have to leave Puerto Rico to find work. I can support my family with the work that I have here. Once my internet service is back and all that, I'll be fine, you know. And then you have a lot of musicians who are fall into the gray area, you know, that you don't, you know, they, you know, they, I spoke to one musician, Angel David Matos, who's a pianist educator, and he said, "We're teaching at the conservatories in the dark, you know, with no electricity, you know, but the classes are still going on." So it depends on who you ask. I mean, but basically, once some of the venues open up and some of the venues that were destroyed maybe are repaired, you may have that same situation where the music starts to uplift the population and people, you know, and it starts to attract a more uplifting sort of feeling there because, you know, things are pretty bad there. I mean, particularly if you live in the rural areas, I mean, there is just no help, you know. And, of course, like you said, the media is not really talking about Puerto Rico that much anymore. So one of the things that happened – yeah, actually, just yesterday was that I got an email from the director of Chamber Music America, and the email was very interesting because what they said was historically, Latin jazz musicians have not received the proper funding for projects and other things that they're doing. And we have $400,000 that we'd like to give to people who are in the Latin jazz field. Can you help us?
Great.
You know? And of course, you know, I responded right away. And today I'm going to be speaking to them at 3 o'clock and seeing how we can get the word out to people who are musicians who are fall into the Latin jazz category, and how we can get them funding for their projects. And you know, and so, you know, right now the need is in Puerto Rico, but, you know, it's ongoing. You know, I mean, if you talk to somebody in Puerto Rico today, they have light, and you talk to them the next day and they say, we just had a power outage, you know, so it's touch and go until they get that grid not only repaired, but to do something, you know, make it better than it was before the storm happened. And in my view, that would be, you know, going with clean energy, solar power, and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
But of course, the administration in Puerto Rico, which is Republican, is actually saying, well, our goal is to have to incorporate 25%, have total budget of 100%. They're saying that the goal is 25% clean energy. You know,
mm-hmm.
where other people are saying, like, you have Tesla down there, you have other private organizations that are installing solar power in the hospitals and stuff. They're saying, why can't it be 50%, 75%?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer to that is, it's political, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You know, yeah. I mean, why shouldn't they go for 100% clean energy? I mean, that would, of course, if there was another storm, you know, there would be damage, but at least you would have a better system in place to be able to, you know, to withstand the storms that are coming, because with climate change, you're seeing how these storms, you know, have increased in magnitude and they're more frequent. So this is going to happen again. So what do you do to prepare as best you can before something like that happens again? And the answer is clean energy.
Exactly.
You know?
You mentioned something about Latin jazz musicians not getting their due on the
in terms of funding.
Yeah. And we should mention kind of ugly episode that happened a couple of years ago where the Grammy people decertified Latin jazz as a category.
Yes.
And now, wonderfully, people stood up and it has been put back as a category. But that was a really hard struggle, because the Grammy people felt like, well, we're done with that and we're not even going to talk about it. And so there's got to be activism to keep all this going. So
yeah,
Tomas, thank you so much for this survey of the contribution of Puerto Rican musicians to jazz.
Sure.
It is, as we both of us pointed out, it's a deep subject. There's some great scholarship on it. We covered some of the most important stories. The first one, of course, being the James Reese Europe Band, and the fact that in 1917, way back when, he made the trip all the way to Puerto Rico to pick up 18 musicians because he felt he needed them. Puerto Rican musicians to realize his vision of an Afro-American orchestra in Europe.
That's
and that
right.
was the first. That was the beginning mm-hmm. of the whole, you know, and where would jazz be without Europe? We'd be in, you know, I don't mean James Reese Europe, but I mean Europe in general, without the support
of
Europe.
Because it started a movement that exists still today. I mean, where, you know, they have utmost respect for jazz musicians and jazz, you know, and that goes on till today.
Yeah, and then we talked a little bit about Juan Tizol and the very important contributions he made to the Ellington Orchestra over the years. Talked a little bit about salsa music jazz, and luckily we talked about Ray Barreto, which is great because you really can't have a conversation like this without mentioning his name and his career.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a wonderful subject, fascinating. The music is great. The history is endless. And I'd like to thank you again for being on the call with us. And just hang on if you would after we end it, because I just want to ask you a quick question offline.
Sure.
But for people that want to follow Thomas's work and Tomas's work, and you should, first place is Jazz de la Peña. I'm going to spell it. It's Jazz, and then D-E-L, and then P-E-N-A. So Jazz, D-E-L-A, P-E-N-A. Jazz de la Peña. And then the other place where you can see his work is the Great Latin Jazz Network, which is based out of Toronto, the great city of Toronto. And of course, if you're in New York City or if you visit New York City, pick up a copy of Hot House Magazine. You can find them at all jazz clubs, and you'll see the Latin side of Hot House. So a lot of great stuff. Tomas, thank you again. And I want to remind everybody.
Thank you.
Yo, you're very welcome. You're very welcome.
Yeah. You know, we skimmed the surface, you know, but that was a chock-filled hour of information that people are going to have to listen to over and over again to really savor what was said.
Yeah, and there's a lot of pointers in the call, and I'll put some links to some of the books that Tomas mentioned and some other resources so that people that want to dive deep into this can do that. And I want to remind everybody one of the reasons we're doing this call. One is I've wanted to do this for a long time, but two, I really feel that jazz fans, we need to keep Puerto Rico in our mind. We need to talk about it. If you go to Jazz on the Tube, one of our menus is Cuba. If you pull the Cuba menu down, you'll see Puerto Rico. Every one of our Puerto Rico articles has a link to a list of organizations that we vetted that you can reliably and safely give your money to if you want to assist Puerto Rico. But even things like contacting your congresspeople and just letting them know that you want the citizens, the U.S. citizens of Puerto Rico, to be helped just like any other citizens would be. That's an important thing. Sharing this interview is a very important thing. Sharing our Puerto Rican pages on Jazz on the Tube, all these things help. So I want to encourage everyone to do that. And I want to say thanks again to Tomas Pena, and definitely check out his writing. It's an education unto itself.
Thank you so much. It was my pleasure.
Great to have you. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please share it. That's how we grow. And remember to subscribe to jazzonthetube.com, the internet's largest collection of free, streamable, classic jazz videos.